You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, healthcare is one of the central issues of the presidential campaign this year. We'll compare proposals from former Vice President Biden and for President Trump and talk about what they could mean for the insurance marketplace. Now, it's the second day of confirmation hearings for President Trump's latest Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett. Unlike yesterday, Coney Barrett faced rounds of questions from both sides of the aisle. The committee is made up of 12 Republicans and 12 Democrats, all but guaranteeing she'll make it to a full vote in the Senate. Coney Barrett would be a big shift from the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and could move the court in a more conservative direction on high-profile issues. On day two of the hearings, Amy Coney Barrett talked about how the nomination and confirmation process has impacted her so far.
I've made distinct choices. I've decided to pursue a career and have a large family. I have a multiracial family. Our faith is important to us. All of those things are true, but they are my choices. And in my personal interactions with people, I mean, I have a life brimming with people who've made different choices, and I've never tried in my personal life to impose my choices on them. And the same is true professionally. I mean, I apply the law, and Senator, I think I should say why I'm sitting in this seat in response to that question, too. Why I've agreed to be here, because I don't think it's any secret to any of you or to the American people that this is a really difficult, some might say excruciating, process.
Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Amy Coney Barrett and the confirmation process so far? What do you think about the move by President Trump to push for the confirmation process in this election year, the election month in effect? Do you support the move to confirm, or should the Senate wait? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Eric T. Casper is professor of political science and director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we have this nominee in front of 12 Republicans, 10 Democrats in the Senate. What are your takeaways from what you've seen so far?
Well, of course, as you mentioned earlier, today is the first day of questioning for the nominee, and so it really gives an opportunity for us to learn a little bit more about what the nominee thinks and what their general constitutional philosophy is, for instance, and a number of questions from senators on kind of major constitutional issues like equal protection of the law, abortion, gun rights, the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, Citizens United. A lot of questions and a lot of statements from senators along those lines today, certainly.
Can you talk about how big an impact this justice could have, or this judge could have, if confirmed as a justice?
Well, the nomination of one person to the Supreme Court, of course, we have to keep in mind it's a court of nine. And so the change of one person isn't going to mean a complete shift in terms of how they might approach these questions, how the court might approach these questions. But because of the fact that based on ideology, Justice Ginsburg is one of the justices on the current court who was much more so on the liberal end of the court. And based on the expected ideology of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, based on rulings that she has issued and decisions and opinions on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the expectation is that she would be farther to the right in terms of those measures of ideology on the Supreme Court. And so what might have been a 5-4 decision one way with Justice Ginsburg in the majority could be a 5-4 decision the other way. But of course, not only is it the case that each of these justices only moves the court a certain extent, because again, it is a court of nine, but the justices themselves will tell you, and the nominee in front of the Senate will typically tell you that they don't think of it in terms of ideology. They think of it in terms of approaching the law and answering these legal questions. And so the way that we might think about it in terms of the popular culture take on it, or the way the media reports it, is not necessarily the way that these individual judges and justices will tend to think of what their job is.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina is the Judiciary Committee chair in the Senate. He questioned Coney Barrett about a number of issues, including how cases make it to the Supreme Court. And he brought up the District of Columbia versus Heller, a Second Amendment case. Here's a bit of their conversation about how Coney Barrett would tackle some of those cases.
It would start because there was a law, then there was a lawsuit, then there was an appeal, then the court granted cert, and then the court decided the case.
Is that true no matter what the issue is, whether it's gun, abortion, health care, campaign finance? Does that process hold true for everything?
Yes. You always know, judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda, I like guns, I hate guns, I like abortion, I hate abortion, and walk in like a royal queen and impose, you know, their will on the world. You have to wait for cases and controversies, which is the language of the Constitution, to wind their way through the process.
That's sad. Those kind of cases do wind their way through to make it into the Supreme Court, ultimately. Can you talk about that that thought on how this all works, Eric?
Sure. And of course, Judge Amy Coney Barrett is correct that the Supreme Court of the United States, like other courts that we have in our system, they have to wait for cases and controversies to come to them. I talk to my students about this, that, you know, courts don't go out there and decide one morning, hey, I want to decide this issue. Right. I mean, they're not legislators. They don't. A legislator can just introduce a bill on any topic that interests the legislator, on the topic that they think is the most pressing, but a judge has to wait for a case to come to them. Now, as you point out, though, I mean, these types of cases on these types of issues, whether it was what was being referenced in that exchange between Senator Graham and Judge Barrett, as far as the Second Amendment, you know, those types of cases certainly do come to the court. And you have to keep in mind that the Supreme Court, the way that it's structured, almost all of its docket is discretionary. In other words, most court, if you think about the trial level court, a case gets filed in front of a trial level court, and it would typically be the case that they would have to hear that case. They don't have a choice. But the U.S. Supreme Court has a large amount of its docket that is discretionary. So there are several thousand cases that are appealed to the court every year, yet they only give full review to currently about 70 cases per year. And so it's only about one that they give full review to, meaning that there are choices the justices can make as far as which types of cases they want to hear. They have criteria that are set up in terms of federal law that they should be considering as far as the types of cases to take for full review. But ultimately, these, as you mentioned, these types of cases do work their way to the court. And if they don't get to choose that they want to decide a case on a particular constitutional issue today, if they're on the court long enough with a lifetime appointment, chances are that those opportunities will eventually arise.
We're talking to Eric Casper, professor of political science and director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies at UW-Eau Claire, with us to talk about the latest on the Amy Coney Barrett hearing in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you listening or watching? What do you think so far? Do you think this is the time to move on this confirmation process? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about Amy Coney Barrett and her path to the Supreme Court. Our guest is Eric T. Casper, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the nomination, the process, the timing, and what you've heard or seen so far in the hearings. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to a caller now. Linda is with us in West Bend. Linda, hi.
Hi. I do believe they should be going ahead with the process for three reasons. First of all, the president is president all the way through almost the end of January. It's not like other countries where as soon as the election is done, power is turned over. Secondly, they haven't brought forward a super controversial candidate. I think they've had proof that people from both sides agree with her, that she is full of integrity and will uphold the law. And thirdly, I think it's hypocrisy if the Democrats are going to suggest that if the situation was reversed, where there was a Democratic president and a Democratic majority in the Senate, we all know that they would do the same thing. So that's why I think they should be going ahead with the nomination.
Linda, thanks a lot for the call. Democrats complaining about the precedent set in the Merrick Garland nomination when President Obama was president and when Republicans controlled the Senate. Eric, how do you sort that out?
Well, obviously, because we were in a similar situation 4 years ago, that really kind of puts the question into focus here. The two parties are on the opposite sides of where they were 4 years ago with the Merrick Garland nomination. Of course, the timing here is an interesting one because of how, not just because it's a presidential election year, but because of how close we are to the election. Depending on how you measure it, there have been about 30 nominations that presidents have made for the Supreme Court in an election year, depending on if you want to judge it by one year previous to the date of the election and counting for 365 days, or just during the presidential election year before the election. So depending on how you want to count it, there are around 30 of those nominations. What we find when we look back historically is that a majority of those nominations, when you've had united government, where the president and the Senate majority are controlled by the same party, a majority of the time we see those types of presidential election year nominations being confirmed and the justices serving. But the percentage there drops to around half or a little less than half when you have divided government historically. If you look back, the previous closest example of a nomination to the Supreme Court during a presidential election year was a nomination made by President Millard Fillmore in August of 1852, where he nominated Edward Bradford for the Supreme Court. And that nomination was tabled, and it was probably tabled in part because there was divided government between the presidency and the Senate. But there are other examples historically of nominations being made, for instance, in July of a presidential election year under united government, where we have seen the Senate move forward and confirm nominees.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Chris now in La Crosse. Chris, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to raise 2 points. On the Merrick Garland issue, I think the Democrats would have no leg to stand on if Mitch McConnell would have just given them a hearing and then voted no. And the other issue I wanted to raise, I take a little bit exception to what you said previously about how judges have to wait for a case to be brought before them, because I cite the example of Justice Alito and Thomas writing that they think now is the time for the gay marriage rights to be challenged again. And they're basically just inviting someone to bring them a case, and they're even providing tips on how to argue that case.
Chris, thanks for the call. And we've talked about that on the show, the two justices, Alito and Thomas, he mentioned saying, hey, yeah, this would be a good time to revisit these things. Do justices sometimes telegraph? Again, they can't just say we're going to do this now, but do they telegraph their interest in cases coming their way?
Most definitely. We've seen that happen historically, where either in a concurring opinion or a dissenting opinion, a justice may send a signal that, you know, if a particular issue were brought to the court, you know, they might be interested in considering that. And so I would agree with the caller 100% in the sense that sometimes we do see the justices sending those signals, and they can do that in a variety of ways. It may be in their opinions on the court. It could be in other writings that they publish. Could be during the questions they ask, even during oral argument. If you're paying close enough attention, you can kind of gauge what the justices are signaling that they might be interested in hearing. So certainly that does go on. But I mean, the point also stands that someone still needs to bring that to the court. And so again, their judges and even justices on the Supreme Court are in a role that is different from legislators, for instance, or the heads of an executive branch at the state or the federal level.
Time for one more caller. Heather is with us in Appleton. Heather, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering how the effects of the nuclear option in eliminating the two-thirds majority vote, in addition to getting rid of the filibuster, has decreased the rights of the minority to have a say in conversations like who should be the next Supreme Court justice.
Interesting question, Heather. Thanks for that. And we saw Democrats take away that filibuster for certain court appointments, Republicans then for Supreme Court justices. Does that take some of the negotiation, the minority participation out of the process, Eric?
Yeah, that was one of the concerns raised when the filibuster was eliminated for Supreme Court nominations in 2017 during the confirmation that ultimately we had the confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch. It had been used a few times previously, and cloture had to be invoked. It was only actually used once successfully in a nomination for the Supreme Court to derail that nomination, which was in actually in a presidential election year in 1968, when President Johnson nominated Abe Fortas from Associate Justice to make him Chief Justice. And that was successfully filibustered, and it killed the nomination. I mean, the idea behind this is that if you don't have that need for kind of crossover appeal between the two parties, then it might ultimately change the types of nominees who are put forth by presidents, that they might be even more ideologically driven than what we've seen in the past. And so there's some concern there that that's not necessarily going to change how someone on the Supreme Court sees their role, but it might change who the president chooses to be a nominee for the Supreme Court.
And briefly, as we wrap up, thanks for that call, Heather. Briefly, one big case we know is coming up a few days after Election Day, the Affordable Care Act. This is would be, if she's confirmed, one of Amy Coney Barrett's first cases she hears.
That's correct. And you have this question here in terms of the what's called the severability of the Affordable Care Act because of the provision that is has been taken out by Congress, the individual mandate. Can the rest of the law stand on its own, including the protection for pre-existing conditions and the lifting of lifetime caps and these sorts of questions? So that will be squarely in front of the court in November. We don't expect that there'll be a decision from the court until sometime in the spring or maybe by the early summer of next year. But they are scheduled to hear that case a week after the election.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Eric T. Casper is professor of political science and director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. He joins us today to talk about the latest with the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Between the COVID-19 pandemic and a challenge to the Affordable Care Act waiting to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, health care has become a big issue in the presidential race. We're taking a look at health care proposals from Democratic candidate Joe Biden, who plans to build on the Affordable Care Act, and President Trump, who has pledged for years to get rid of the ACA and replace it with something better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What changes would you like to see to the health care system? Which candidate's vision for health care do you think would do the most good? Does either worry you? And what questions do you have about different health care proposals and the impact they could have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Philip Rocco is assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be with you, Rob.
Well, briefly, before we dig into the plans, healthcare, is it shaping up as you see it to be a big issue this election season?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the list of issues that are at the top of voters' minds, healthcare is a little bit further down the list than it usually might be. But I think one reason that is that COVID-19 and the pandemic response more generally has soaked up a lot of public interest and attention. And it's sort of become a sort of photo negative for a lot of other opinions, including opinions about the economy and healthcare. So, I mean, I think, you know, regardless of where you put healthcare third, fourth, it is ultimately going to be a pretty big thing that's on folks' minds.
All right, let's look at each candidate in turn now. First, Democratic nominee Joe Biden. He was vice president when the Affordable Care Act passed. What are you hearing from him and his campaign when it comes to his vision for healthcare if he were elected?
Well, I think it's helpful to go through the different ways that people get healthcare, because the nature of the plan is going to vary really depending on what part of the healthcare sector you're looking at. So we could just start with the employer-sponsored healthcare. So Biden, unlike some of his rivals in the Democratic field, really did not propose any major changes. If you have employer-sponsored insurance, you're going to be able to keep that. The only thing that he really changed on that one was to extend COBRA protection. So if you lose your job during the pandemic, his proposal, like Democrats passed in the House, would extend 100% of subsidy for premium if you lose your job during the pandemic. The federal government would pick up 100% of your COBRA premiums. The only other change that Biden made to that, to the employer side of things, is to allow people who have employer-sponsored insurance to buy into a public option offered on the ACA marketplaces, which would look a lot like Medicare Advantage. Now, in practice, because of the nature of plans and the income level that people have who have employer-sponsored insurance, most people who already have insurance from their employer probably aren't going to opt to go on to the public option. But for people who work for small businesses and have insurance, their premiums and their cost sharing tend to be a lot higher than folks who work for a larger employer. And so it's entirely possible that employers would effectively buy into that to that plan. So that would reduce some of the instability that's been in the sort of small employer marketplace. But when it comes to the really big changes, there's not that much on the employer-sponsored side. And when it comes to ACA marketplaces, there is a little bit more movement here. So one thing that the Biden plan would do would be to expand eligibility for financial assistance to include people who have over 400% of the federal poverty level, and make some premium tax credits a little bit more generous there. So if you're a 40-year-old making $50,000 a year, there's been a study from the Urban Institute that suggests that you would save about 32% a month on premiums under the Biden plan compared to what you would be getting now. And then there would be a reduction of out-of-pocket cost sharing, basically making all of the plans look like the best plan in terms of the cost sharing there. So, I mean, in the end, this is sort of building on the Affordable Care Act and taking some of the biggest gaps that were in the plan and sort of expanding it. When it comes to Medicaid, under the Biden plan, I mean, I think the really big headline thing for Wisconsinites here is that under Biden's plan, the public option would be available to people in states that have not chosen to expand Medicaid. And Wisconsin is one of those states, which basically mean that 176,000 people would be eligible to be automatically enrolled in that plan. So that's, I think, at least for Wisconsinites, that's a fairly large increase in the number of people who have insurance.
And I want to give a listen to Joe Biden talk about that on the presidential debate stage. Here's a listen.
It's only for those people who are so poor they qualify for Medicaid. They can get that free in most states, except governors who want to deny people who are poor Medicaid. Anyone who qualifies for Medicare would, Medicaid would automatically be enrolled in the public option. The vast majority of the American people would still not be in that option.
So this would be not a huge number of people covered, even in Wisconsin. Is that fair to say?
This would be, I mean, there are 12 states that have not yet expanded Medicaid. In those states, including Wisconsin, there are varying sort of eligibility or coverage gaps. Wisconsin's is on the smaller side in terms of those coverage gaps. But it is 176,000 people, and you know, if you are one of those people and you're in that gap, I mean, it would mean, I think, quite a lot. But just in scale terms, it's not quite as big. I think one of the sleeper elements of Biden's plan that's not really been picked up on that much is lowering the Medicare eligibility age to 60. So if you are between the ages of 60 and 64, you could either keep the coverage you have or go into Medicare. Now, I think one of the reasons that hasn't gotten a lot of attention is people who are in their early 60s overall, on balance, tend to have insurance to their employer to a greater degree than younger people do because they're sort of brought in on a different set of bargaining terms. But especially if the economy tends to be unstable right now, and people who are in their early 60s are deciding about whether or not to let go, to retire, or whether or not they're let go. I mean, that could actually be pretty significant. An entry point of 62 would add, I think, 670,000 people nationwide who were uninsured to the Medicare rolls. So, I mean, overall, the Biden plan sort of looks like there are some major coverage expansions that we see there, but it's an attempt to do that in a way that does not really upset the apple cart of the existing system. So, you know, you're still going to have employer-sponsored insurance with some of the benefits of that, but also some of the churn that happens. And I think that the fact that we are seeing such sort of uncertainty in the economy, and the fact that people who lose their jobs also lose their insurance, I mean, it doesn't necessarily in a big structural way deal with that, at least beyond the span of the immediate emergency.
Talking to Philip Rocco from Marquette University, looking at the presidential campaigns and their plans for health care. Let's turn to the Trump campaign now. He ran on the case that he would overturn the Affordable Care Act, that it didn't end up happening by a narrow vote in the Senate. What are you hearing from the Trump campaign about their priorities in a second term?
Yeah, this is actually a lot harder to describe because you've heard sort of conflicting things out of the Trump campaign. I want to try to be sensitive to both of those sets of things that we've heard. So on the one hand, the last sort of 4 years, the Trump administration has supported repealing the Affordable Care Act, both legislatively in 2017, which failed, but also through a lawsuit that is currently slated to go before the Supreme Court in a few weeks. Additionally, administratively, changing some of the rules, including allowing short-term health plans to go into the market that have more exclusions for pre-existing conditions, additional sort of eliminating of cost-sharing reductions to insurers who are in the marketplace. So, I mean, in general, in addition to sort of supporting repeal in the long run, the administration did a lot to make the policy more unworkable during its 4 years. At the same time, you know, there's been this executive order that came out from the administration a few weeks ago that has essentially said that it is, quote, the policy of the United States that people with pre-existing conditions would be protected. Now, in point of fact, it's hard to say what that means. So on the one hand, it could just mean that the ACA's pre-existing condition protections are the law of the land. But without premium subsidies, without Medicaid expansion, without a number of the regulatory devices that the ACA created, the meaning of that phrase, you know, protecting people with pre-existing conditions is sort of hard to square. And if you look at for example, the plan that was advanced in the House and Senate in 2017 by Republicans, the projected impact on the number of people who would have insurance was grim. Millions of people would in fact have lost it. But I think it's very politically challenging in an election year to be specific about any kind of plan that would, you know, nominally make major changes that would reduce the number of people who had insurance. And so I think it's been really difficult for the administration to sort of articulate a clear plan that, in a sense, supports the thing that they are talking about, right? The one thing that I think is very clear where the campaign is concerned is that getting rid of protections for people with pre-existing conditions is incredibly unpopular. And additionally, a lot of the other elements of the ACA individually, when you don't frame it as Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, are also popular. Once you start talking about it symbolically, then partisan sort of inclinations kick in and parties sort of go to their opposite, people in different parties go to their opposite camps. But I think that makes at least on the ACA side, kind of difficult to parse what the administration would do. I think that the lack of clarity gets sort of worse when you look at Medicaid. So right now, the ACA lawsuit that the administration's involved in would, if the Supreme Court, you know, agrees with the administration's position, would lead to the repeal of Medicaid expansion. Additionally, during the 4 years, the administration has pursued eligibility requirements within Medicaid that, were they not to be struck down by some lower courts, would have increased the number of people without insurance. And in the state where they were implemented, Arkansas, there was a huge drop in the number of people with coverage because of that. But
we're talking to Philip Rocco. Got to jump in, Phil, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, author of the book Obamacare Wars. We're looking at healthcare plans from the Biden and Trump campaigns. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions of what you would hope for or worry about from either candidate. 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Phil Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, comparing health care plans from President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Aaron is with us in Chicago. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that one thing that frustrates me in discussing the failures of the ACA, because symbolically and in many ways, functionally, I think it's a win. But the people who are largely opposed to it are mainly upset by the massive increase to their premiums over the years and the decrease in the value of the plan. And I feel like premium subsidies doesn't really address that. And I want both campaigns to address the issue that it's the health insurance companies who are causing the ACA to fail. Like, their model of the higher the premium, the lower the deductible, and vice versa, is what's really causing this to fail. So that's
Phil. Thanks for the call, Aaron. Phil, she's saying we need to look more at the insurance company role in what people actually have to pay, even under the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are two parts of this, right? The first is that, you know, insurance is a product that that insurers profit from, right? And so, yeah, the general structure of it, there will be if the product is ultimately the negotiations they have with providers are you know, get increasingly costly, they're passing on that cost to us so that they can profit. But the overall trajectory of like why healthcare has become so costly is that in general the costs that are being charged, you know, to the insurers and ultimately passed on to us have been going up. And really, neither campaign makes cost control in this realm a sort of flagship part of their platform, right? It's about sort of plugging the holes. And, you know, at the end of the day, medical inflation is still going to be a lot higher than regular inflation. And in a way, because we don't really regulate the costs of those services in a substantial way, we have multiple payers, it can be really, really difficult to control those costs in the long term, which is why even if you are insured, your premiums and your cost sharing have probably inched up over the years. And so, you know, really, unless you see a plan that addresses that head on, you know, there's going to be a slow, steady increase and an increase in the number of people who are what our researchers call underinsured, meaning you have insurance, but it really doesn't pay most of the costs that you need. You're effectively paying twice.
Thanks for the call, Aaron. We'll go to Lee and Rui. Lee, hello.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Lee. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm just... So we have a 19-year-old and an 18-year-old daughter, and I have good health insurance through John Deere. I'm wondering if the ACA is overturned. Will they lose? Is there a possibility they will lose their health insurance through my employer?
Lee, thanks for the call. Lee worried that his 19- and 18-year-old would lose their health coverage if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, Phil.
So if the ACA is repealed in its entirety, if the court agrees with the administration on the severability clause, there would be nothing preventing insurers from cutting dependents who are above the age of 18 but below the age of 26 off of the plans and off of your employer's plan. It doesn't mean that every insurer would do that, but especially if there's a sort of cost pressure on the insurer or the employer, they would have no legal incentive not to do that, right? And so I think it just in general is going to increase the probability that that happens.
Thanks for that call, Lee. Chris joins us next in Wazaki. Chris, hi.
Hi. I just want to point out that as somebody who's worked in healthcare for over 30 years, I think a lot of people don't realize that the rules and the laws that are changed don't just affect those that get their healthcare off of the exchange. So I have employer-sponsored healthcare, but the rules and laws that are changed and passed, those affect everybody. I mean, it isn't just those that are getting their healthcare off of the health exchange. And as somebody who was just diagnosed with breast cancer, of course, you know, it's concerning to me that, again, the rules that are made are going to affect even my coverage, everybody's coverage.
Chris, thanks for the call. Sorry to hear about that diagnosis and best to you. Chris, thanks for the call. And Phil, you were touching on this earlier. People think Affordable Care Act and sometimes think about the marketplace. As Chris says, this affects people with employer-sponsored insurance too.
Indeed. And Chris, sorry to hear about that diagnosis, and I wish you the best. I do think it's important to recognize that a lot of the regulatory provisions of the ACA applied far more broadly, yes, than the individual marketplace and the Medicaid expansion, but indeed applied to people with employer-sponsored insurance. And the previous example, the allowing your dependents to be on your insurance up to the age of 26 is just another example of this. Beyond that, limits on lifetime limits on out-of-pocket spending would be another example. But the list goes on, and in fact, it's hard to even summarize the number of changes that have unfolded. And I think for everything that we're able to say about how the repeal of the ACA would affect the health insurance market, everything we're able to estimate with sort of forecasts and projections, there's going to be a lot that we won't be able to predict because the health insurance or healthcare sector is 17% of gross domestic product. And so, yeah, the effects will go very much to the protections that are in the law that affect everybody, even beyond the people who just gained insurance as a result of its passage.
Thanks again for that call. In our just last minute or so, Phil, do we need more information from the candidates, do you think, or do you think that there's enough to go on for voters at this point when it comes to healthcare?
I mean, I think the thing to note if you're a voter on this, which is that like probably what I just said sounded like an alphabet soup of jargon. But I think that the broad outlines of what's happened over the last 4 years give an indication, if not about the specifics, then about the direction of the two different parties' plans. The sort of the record of the administration has suggested that regardless of what the administration might have wanted, getting Republicans in the Senate and in the House on board with any particular plan, even a repeal plan, was difficult. And so, I mean, it's likely that would be the general direction of the administration in the future, even though they haven't been clear about it.
Phil, and thanks. We'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He talked with us about the health care proposals from President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden.